Think about the last time you had to cancel a subscription. There's probably some waiting on hold, some guessing at your password, some mind-numbing small talk. And maybe, after all of that, you still weren't able to cancel it. Good news, it doesn't have to be this way, thanks to Rocket Money. Rocket Money tracks, manages, and can cancel your subscriptions for you. When you connect your accounts, you'll see a complete picture of all of your recurring subscriptions all in one place. Rocket Money organizes your subscriptions by due date and notifies you when something is coming up, so you'll never be caught off guard when you get charged. If you see a subscription you want to cancel, Rocket Money simplifies the process. Instead of waiting on hold for an hour, you can cancel it right from the app. Rocket Money will even try to get you a refund for the money you spent on subscriptions you forgot about. Stop wasting time trying to cancel subscriptions the hard way. Make your life easier and go to rocketmoney.com/cancel. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel, or download the app from the Apple App or Google Play stores.
Hello, it is Ryan, and I was on a flight the other day playing one of my favorite social spin slot games on chumbacasino.com. I looked over at the person sitting next to me, and you know what they were doing? They were also playing Chumba Casino. Everybody's loving having fun with it. Chumba Casino is home to hundreds of casino-style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere. So sign up now at chumbacasino.com to claim your free welcome bonus. That's chumbacasino.com and live the Chumba life.
Sponsored by Chumba Casino.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 21 plus. Terms and conditions apply.
You know, for me, I'm really enjoying working with him. I think everyone's seen he's got good charisma. He likes to a few bets with me in the garage on different topics during qualifying, so I didn't earn much money last year. but yeah, it's been a lot of fun having him around as well.
Hello and welcome to the James Allen on F1 podcast, brought to you by Autosport. Now, this week, we're going to chat to Formula One's youngest team principal, Oliver Oakes. The 37-year-old was parachuted into the Alpine team in August last year when they were struggling down in ninth place in the team's championship. They ended the season sixth. Ollie is the first to admit that there was a slice of luck involved in this, as the bulk of their points were scored with that amazing double podium in the wet in Brazil. But underneath that was an upward trend on car development, and ultimately, they deserved their finishing position. So what happens next? And is Oliver a mighty oak? Is he the stabilising force that Alpine has been crying out for? And with rookie drivers making an astonishing 30% of the F1 field, we get Oliver's take on why F1 is going for youth. In the studio with me to discuss this are our international editor, Oleg Karpov. How are you?
Oh, I'm fine, James. Thanks for having me.
And we've got BBC Five Live commentator, podcaster, former F1 mechanic and friend of the pod, Mark Priestley. How's it going, Mark?
Very well, James. Yeah, nice to be back. Thanks, mate.
Thanks for coming back. We'll start with you then, Mark. What did you make of Alpine last season? A bit of a game of two halves, really, as they say in football.
Yeah, I mean, it does very much look like that, doesn't it? If you look at the results, and that really was a big shift. You know, that result that you mentioned in Brazil was a real turning point for them. And that, you have to say, there was a huge amount of luck involved in that. But I think when you start a season as poorly as they did in 2024 with a car that was heavily overweight, there was always a huge amount of room for improvement. And you've got to give the team credit for that. Whether the amount of credit that goes directly to Ollie, having come in, you know, so late, I think even he would accept that he joined a team that was already making steady improvements. But you've got to look at any Formula One team's progress over a season. And if they've taken steps like they have, that goes down as progression. That goes down as a good, you know, positive movement for a team. So I guess on that front, you've got to give them credit.
Oleg, the Alpine team, based in the factory that was once graced by Schumacher's Benetton team, Alonso's Renault team, and it's had a pretty choppy time of late. They finished fifth in 2021, then fourth in 22, and then the last two seasons they were sixth, but their share of points seems to have dropped from 173 in 2023 to just 65 last year. What do you make of this team?
Well, look, I think the second part of last year was a little bit more representative in terms of what we can expect from Alpine. There were two very different halves of that season, as you said, and I'd say the latter part of the year, we simply saw what Alpine is really capable of. Maybe it's easy to say it now, but with the, you know, resources they have in Enstone, they have to be somewhere around P6 in the standings. So I guess that's just coming back to where it belongs. And that's in the midfield. And can we expect more from them this year? I think, honestly, with so many management changes in recent years, I think it's a little bit unrealistic. And you know, James, you mentioned Schumacher and Alonso years as well, and the title winning campaigns. And there is always talk about the team's DNA, be it McLaren or Alpine in this case, but in the end, does it really matter what the team was capable of doing in the past? And I think we hear that's a good thing to put into the in the interview for someone like Colli, for example. And when we spoke with him for Autosport magazine, he mentioned something like that people at Anston they didn't forget how to build a fast car, right? And in the end of the day, until does it really matter until you start doing the right things again? Does that DNA really help?
That's a good point, actually. I mean, one of the things, Oleg, that was for me that was really interesting was, you know, I've gone to that factory in Enstone kind of every two or three years, I guess, since the early 1990s. I remember the first time I went there, you know, in the Benetton years. And so much of it is the same. You know, obviously the technology's moved on, a lot of the people have moved on. But there is, you know, the drawing office, the whole layout of it, the windows, you know, everything about it, the buildings, it's still got that history. You do definitely feel it. And it was really interesting for me to step back into that and to think, I remember going to interview Ross Brawn there when I was working for ESPN TV back in 1993, 94, you know, such a long time ago. Anyway, listen, I went down to the factory, as I say, in leafy Oxfordshire just a few days ago, actually, to meet up with Oliver Oakes. And I hope you enjoy our conversation. Ollie, thanks so much for making the time. It's great to see you. And it's great to be here in Enstone. I've been coming here for over 30 years, and some things are reassuringly familiar about it, and some things feel very fresh.
Oh, well, thanks for coming in. It's a shame about the British weather. But I think you've seen the site. There are things that have sort of changed and stuff that's still familiar from, yeah, I don't know when you were last here, but yeah.
About 3 or 4 years ago, but it's great. And obviously you've been in for like half a season now and quite a transformation. I mean, there's always a bit of luck involved in doing well in racing, as you know better than anybody, but you know, you make your luck as well. And so second half of last year, you know, you came in and you went from 9th to 6th in the constructors, bit of luck in, yeah, and good judgment in Brazil. But what did you learn from that half season?
Yeah, I mean, look, it's not lost on me. You know, our season did heavily rely, or that turnaround, on a bit of luck and good fortune in Brazil. I think you could look at it two ways there as well, because we're obviously pretty decent there on the Saturday in the sprint when it was dry, and, you know, Sunday in the rain, car, drivers, team, you know, everything went our way, which I always say in motorsport, you need to thank the sort of racing god up there on those days. But I think, you know, more serious than that really was, it was a really good turnaround by everybody across Enstone and Viri. I think obviously, you know, it seems slightly weird talking about that now in January as you get on for the next season and looking back on it, because you've had Christmas and you sort of go, whoa, that was a busy run in for me, particularly when you were sort of dropped in after the summer break. But I think it was just great to see the team really all stick together. And, you know, they had a tough start to the year, but everybody really did muck in and bring performance to the car, which, yeah, I think is pretty difficult today under these regulations, and sort of not only bringing performance, but does it work? Then the swings track to track. And I think, you know, more reassuring than just getting back P6 was really sort of some of the speed we were showing those past few events. I think, you know, that sets us up well for this season. I think it's obviously difficult always to gauge where you are. I think we know the end of last year, Haas were extremely quick, and full credit to them, those last few races. They kept us very honest. And obviously you've seen in the midfield, you know, it's so tight track to track as well.
You interest me a lot because the kind of pathway you've come through, you're a driver, a very, very good kart racing driver, a champion. You worked your way through single seaters, and then at a certain point realised that you perhaps weren't going to make it. You were a finalist in the Autosport Young Driver competition
along
with some great names over the years. So
yeah, that was a good day, actually. I remember that. Snetterton, actually. In the cold, in the rain there. And I think it was a World Series car at the time and a DTM car, I think. A great, great event, actually, as well. And obviously still going to this day as well.
Yeah. So you took that pathway. And that used to be quite a common pathway. You know, you look at people like Eddie Jordan. You look at people like Christian Horner. There's many, many examples of people who were drivers, set up their own teams, which you did with High Tech, with great success in Formula 3 and Formula 2 and other series. But more recently, we've seen more kind of engineers becoming team principals. You know, there's quite a lot of them now. I mean, half the grid, I think, has got an engineer as a team principal. Just had Andy Cowell now come in as the latest one. What do you think is the benefit, the upside, if you like, of coming at it from the pathway that you and Eddie and Christian people did?
I don't know. I always think everybody's got different strengths, different things they bring. And I always say this, I don't believe it's about the individual. I believe it's about the chemistry, the sort of structure around them and how they all fit together. You know, not to say F1 is too similar to football, but it is about everyone, you know, working as a collective. And, you know, I think it's not fair to judge on what others bring and how similar we are together. I know a lot of parallels get drawn between me and a few others, which is natural given our backgrounds. But I think, you know, in F1 actually, you know, every team has a different sort of layup of people, reporting lines, who's managing what. I think obviously over the years, you know, different phases in Formula One, you can see a different approach has been taken. I think obviously you can have a team principal who's from a very engineering background and very hands-on in terms of car development and I dare say not letting go of that. And you can combine that with a CEO who's taking care of the boardroom and the politics. I think I've seen it work both ways, actually. I think the one thing I sort of said when I came to Enstone really was, you know, what had gone on in the past and, you know, the different structure we had there, that I think it's pretty straightforward now with Luca, myself and Flavio. And, you know, I think as an ex-driver, what I've done, you know, you've got that sort of background of knowing a little bit about getting the best of those people around you. And I think from the other side of High Tech, you've sort of got a little bit of, when I say entrepreneurial, I kind of look at it differently, not from a little bit of the business acumen, but more of the operations side, running the day-to-day and being hands-on. And I think, you know, all of that's been, you know, a good skill set to have when I was thrown in here. And I think it's something that, you know, daily you're learning new things, but also there's a lot of similarities as well. Yeah.
It's interesting. I guess one of the things is the fact that you've been used to spending your own money. Any cost that you have to commit to when you're running your own high tech team or whatever, it's like, do we need this? Is it going to make our team more competitive? Is it going to make us car go faster? Because it's my money.
Yeah,
whereas if you've come up the ranks, has always been an employee, you approach it perhaps a bit differently.
Exactly. But. And there is a bit of that. I mean, sadly, I'm from Norfolk, not from Yorkshire, so I'm not completely tight, but I do control the purse strings. But actually, you know, I think I said it early on, and it is still a little bit who I am today. You know, I like the focus on the going racing bit, and, you know, as much money as we can spend should go into the car before everything else. There's obviously a balance there, because you need your infrastructure, you need to make investments in the technology, but, you know, you do have to be very clear that we are here to go racing first. I think obviously when I think back of my past and what set me up reasonably well from an experience side for doing what I'm doing now, I think one of the main parallels I think was that first year I had High Tech, when I, you know, we started in F3. It was the era of Formula 3 where there was aero development, there was, you know, pretty big team of, you know, four cars. The championship was very different to F3 today, which is a little bit more one make. And I think that was a good experience, because there you were managing going racing, a development program, you know, lots of things that, it is something that has dawned on me lately, going, I was pretty lucky to have that as my first sort of foray to sort out with High Tech. Yeah,
you got a chance to see what good looks like as well, because you worked with a very young George Russell at the time. We'll come on to talk about young drivers in a minute, because it's one thing I know you really want to get your thoughts on. But you mentioned Flavio just before. obviously tremendous history in the sport, Flavio, and here at Enstone particularly. I mean, yeah. He kind of built this place in the first instance with the Benetton and the Renault years. I mean, it would be easy for someone like him to come back in here and say, well, we used to do it like this and we always do it like that and what have you. But I get the feeling with him, he's not that kind of person. He's not someone
who... He does it a bit. Only in jest to me.
But yeah. what does he take care of and what do you take care of?
I mean... I dare say we're probably in everything together. And I mean that, you know, he's here today. He's probably, you know, 1 or 2 days a week most of the time. We travel together to races. We're on the phone every day. And, you know, for me, that's really helpful. It's not because I need it or he needs it. It's just genuinely because we're both vested in what we're trying to do here and we care about the team. And for me, it's just a good sounding board to bounce ideas off. You know, teams are big today. It's not just the going racing bit. There's also the commercial side. There's the sort of business side of what we're doing as well. You know, everybody knows the topics about Concords and new teams. There's all this stuff that we divide up amongst ourselves. And, you know, I wouldn't go as far to say as it's very binary of I'm handling this, he's handling that. We're in most things together. And, you know, there are different things where, you know, I set him off or he sets me off to help each other. But the biggest thing is just we do all sing off the same hymn sheet, which I think, you know, it's quite important today that the leadership of a team is strong and honest together and, you know, it's got each other's back as well because, you know, F1 is... It's complex. There's a lot going on. It's very easy to point fingers at each other without knowing really the background of stuff. And, you know, for me, I'm really enjoying working with him. You know, he's got, I think everyone's seen, he's got good charisma. He likes to do a few bets with me in the garage on different topics during qualifying. So I didn't earn much money last year. but yeah, it's been a lot of fun having him around as well.
So your whole career, basically, most of your life has been about competing. It's been about racing, either behind the wheel yourself or, you know, with your own team or now with a Formula One team. Can you describe for the listeners that sense of exhilaration when, you know, a great organization of people comes together and you put an amazing result together and how you see the people that work under you, their faces light up, that whole vibe when you get back? What's that feeling like?
Yeah, I mean, it's hard to describe because I think there's a feeling when you're a driver and you win. Obviously, that raw emotion as you cross the line, that's one thing that you can never lose. And then you kind of get a bit of that when you're successful with a team or you know, your group of people. But I think the biggest satisfaction I take really is when you see... And it isn't always a big result. It's when you see really things working well together. And sometimes that's even actually, sorry for the bad word, but in a sort of shit fight where, you know, everyone's up against it and you see different areas of the team or the garage working together, whether it's a quick engine change, whether it's a curveball last minute pre-quali for a setup change, and you see both sides of the garage help, you know, come together and you're just proud going, that's great. You know, that ethos is there. And that I really like. I love, you know, we just had it recently, you know, our 26 car in the wind tunnel, seeing that ground zero and what went into that the last few months to hit the ground running there and balancing what we're doing now. And I think, you know, that's something you know, if you don't enjoy that, you know, you shouldn't be here at the end of the day, because that is what makes you want to come to work. And I say this a few times and I don't know if people understand it, but it's an odd responsibility when you're leading an F1 team, because on one side, people at home watch on the telly, they care about the result. Obviously, they do know what goes into it. They're not naive. But I think perhaps from the other side, that responsibility goes deeper, actually, because your job is to build a culture in a team, to make people feel empowered, to make them know they're supported. Because it's probably just as easy to get it wrong as it is to get it right as well. And you can't get it right all the time. And I think, you know, that's something I enjoy. And it really does become the thing that you every day want to see developing, whether that's a seed you've planted in a certain area of the business where you're going, we need to be better at that. Yeah, That's the bit I like.
It's like a constant feedback loop, isn't it? That is the nature of
it never Formula stops, 1. Unfortunately.
Yeah, it's relentless. It's relentless. But there's a phrase you use a lot, I've noticed, which is you talk about making a difference. And clearly you're here to make a difference. You want to, what gives you satisfaction and what you will make you feel it's a job well done as you go along is the sense that you came here and you made a difference. So I guess you feel the same way about everybody, whether they work in the comms department or the composites or the design department and the drivers. Everybody, if they feel you can foster that culture of making a difference, that will be success to you.
Yeah, I kind of, when you say it like that, I think, oh God, have I used it too much? Because it's not an arrogant thing of that it's about me making a difference. It's more that...
Everybody making a difference.
I think it's everyone feeling that, you know, they play their part, they're supported. Because I think one thing, you know, and I want to say it was missing before I came, but I don't mean that people weren't doing their job. I think it's just very easy when... You know, they're big organizations now, and you know, the team had been through a lot, it's been well documented, and different people have given their opinions on that. I really feel that you want everyone to know that the things that aren't right, they can make them better. You know, it's easy to moan about them, it's easy to say, well, it's always been like that, but actually it's like, no, we can fix it. I'm here, my door's open, let's, you know, on my watch, you know, it's on my shoulders, let's genuinely get that sorted. You know, it's never as easy as that. I wish it was, because some of the things that come to you go, God, it's going to take a year or two. But genuinely, you know, that is a bit of an ethos that, you know, I want to make sure that we aren't just resting on laurels. We are trying to push ourselves. And I think it was something already here in the team happening before I joined, because I said it a couple of times, but it almost feels slightly awkward to me that, you know, when people were saying, oh, you know, everything's gone well since you've come and it's been a good turnaround. And I find it awkward because I haven't had that effect actually in the team. It's important to say that. I think, you know, since I've been here, everyone's been really welcoming to me. You know, I'm only the young guy. Everyone's been well documented. I was only 36 and I didn't know anything. But the team actually, really, the beginning of the season, they really did muck in, and, you know, they were really unhappy with the car we'd launched. It was overweight. I think David was really honest in an article the other day of where we were suffering a bit on our aero development. And I think it's great. You know, those things were already... You know, the seeds were planted before I came. I feel what I've given a little bit so far is just a bit of a focus on, you know, the first thing is about the team, our people, going racing. And from that, we'll build. Yeah.
Perfect. Well, we'll come on to talk about this upcoming season, because to me, it looks like it's probably going to be the closest in living memory. But we'll come back to that in a minute. Yeah. I just want to get your thoughts on young drivers, because, you know, you've had quite a few pass through your hands when you're running high tech. You were one yourself. I'm interested in your views on the caliber of the drivers that we're seeing come through at the moment. I did an interview with Fernando Alonso during the second half of last season and asked him to sort of compare these kind of drivers that are coming through. We saw what Behrman did in Jeddah with almost no notice. You know, how could that possibly happen? Because he's been in academy for many years, because he's been in the simulator, because they're super well prepared. And he actually, Alonso said to me, you know what, these guys are more prepared than we were, and they probably are better than myself, Raikkonen, and people like that when we came in the early 2000s because of all these tools.
How do you see that? It's always hard to judge, if I'm really honest, because I think, you know, the level of an F2, F3 championship today is very high. You know, you can see the cars are proper, they're close in lap time to F1. The teams there, I'm going to be biased because I have a team there, but the way they're operating now, you know, is pretty high. You know, they using simulators to prepare drivers, you know, the engineers there are of a good caliber. So already those young drivers, as they're coming through in F2, F3, are already racing at a high level in teams that are, you know, operating at a high level. Then you caveat that, or caveat to that as well, is the job F1 teams have been doing in terms of nearly every F1 team now has an academy. They're giving mileage to these drivers in older cars. Yeah. You know, the simulator programs are really well run. So they're very well prepared to get in an F1 car. The bit I would say that's still there is the real good ones don't need any of that. They get in and day one they are bang on the money. And I think, you know, me and Flavio had a good chat on that in Abu Dhabi actually, and it was one of the reasons we dropped Aaron in the car, you know, straight on the Tuesday testing. You know, he said to me, what's your view? I was like, well, he's good enough, just throw him in. He hadn't done any sim, he just joined Alpine, but you know, and he hit the ground running. And I think, you know, again with Biermann, you know, I think Ollie's credentials over the years, he's a phenomenal talent, he's a lovely kid, but all the preparation in the world doesn't make jumping into Saudi into that race easy. But more than talent was he could handle all the pressure and he could deliver in that moment. And for me, you know, it's a great wave of youngsters coming through now into F1. And it does happen like that, doesn't it? You kind of end up with a rich vein of a herd of drivers that you go, God, where did they all come from? And suddenly three or four have got in. And I think we saw that.
Well, it's more than that this year. Yeah. If you look at the field, there's a lot of rookies in there. And even someone like Lawson's not got that much experience, you know.
It's true. I mean,
So the point really from the way I'm looking at it is, something's happened here. Yes, of course, we've got some talent, but it's also the confidence of people like you and Toto to stick Antonelli and you and Flavio to stick Doohan in, you know?
Yeah, well, I think that's a lot of it. I mean, I think Helmut has always been the one who's been leading that. And I think, you know, you can see that very clearly with Red Bull for this year. He's sort of got his way there, which is correct. You know, at the end of the day, it's good to bring in young blood. I think it keeps everyone fresh. But I kind of also still believe it's exciting to see all of that go up against Fernando, because he is still the reference. Obviously, met him a little bit now working with Flavio, and you know, I'm laughing, he's always at the track late, he's always coming to say bye, and you go, God, that is just as impressive as someone young there, of you know how committed and hungry he still is to
over
perform.
400 Grand Prix.
Yeah, it's so impressive. Yeah.
It is. It's phenomenal. It's the relentlessness of Alonso is much underrated. But at the other end of the scale, you've mentioned Jack Doohan, because you got the chance to put him in a car at the end of last season.
Yep.
So you've got a rookie who's coming in, potentially a rookie who's coming in this year, who's never driven in a Grand Prix before, and then versus a guy who did get to do a whole Grand Prix weekend. How much of a difference is that going to make to his preparation for this year, that he was able to go away and have a real good look at how he performed and what he learned and all that?
I think you know, it's always hard to calculate that. But I think if you peel it all back, the number one thing for me there was he's just done a weekend that he knows what to expect. You know, when we get to Australia, it's a big home race for him. You know, I dare say it takes away a little bit of the rawness of the emotion he's going to go through. And for the team, it just makes that settling in process slightly easier. Obviously, we've got a bit of stick publicly for that, dropping him in and letting Esteban go early, but it was as straightforward as it just made complete sense for the team. At the end of the day, we want to give Jack the best chance to perform, and he did a solid job in Abu Dhabi. I felt for him a bit his final run in Q1, because the first run was really good. We got a bit caught out leaving the garage late, and you know, he was in that cluster, that last sector there, which just really affected his prep lap. But he did a good job, he kept his nose clean. I think it'll be a big help. At the end of the day, it'll still be what it will be, because motorsport's like that. With all the preparation in the world, there'll be something that still can catch you out.
And since the end of the season, you've also you'd already signed up, you mentioned Pete Aaron earlier on.
Yep.
Who was very, very effective in Formula 2, and he's in the reserve capacity. You've also opportunistically dived in and grabbed Colapinto Pinto as well, who got a lot of people excited for a while last year, until he started crashing a bit towards the end, which I think maybe put
that was a big bill. Yeah.
Well, especially in a cost control environment, because you have like a contingency for damage, don't
yes,
you?
And yeah.
And you know, if you don't
learn all of that,
if you don't spend it because no one crashes, you can actually spend it on other things that make the car go faster. Exactly. You really don't want someone to crash, but
it's a constant compromise. Yeah.
So tell us about that.
Yeah, I mean, look, I think Franco did a great first impression, let's say, with Williams. I think it was clear to see that probably tried a bit too hard at the end there. How much of that was the situation he was in, where you know he didn't have a seat confirmed and was trying to over impress? How much of that was, you know, a bit of compromise on parts on the car? And you know, all of that's hard to calculate, but I think the crux is he made a strong impression with the speed he showed. I think for us as a team, And, you know, they were quite vocal in an interview a few days ago over Flavio being impressed with what he'd done and wanting to bring him to Alpine. And for me, it's great to have that roster we've got there of, you know, two young drivers in Paul and Franco there waiting in the wings, because, you know, it's not just 25, 26, 27 is around the corner. And it is, you know, it's hard in F1 to plan what's going to happen and what drivers you're going to have to go in the car. And I think for us, it just keeps everyone honest in terms of how they're performing and gives us options.
I think it's very smart, I have to say. There's a great saying in Formula One throughout my time, which is in Formula One, you're either giving pressure or you're taking it.
Yep. Yeah, that's true. That's true. And I think it's definitely one way or the other.
When it comes to keeping your two race drivers focused and on the case, then there's nothing quite like having a couple of hot shoes sitting around.
Yeah, I mean, that is very true. I think it's not lost on me as well that, you know, it's been a little bit harsh on Jack, some of the stuff that was written by the keyboard warriors there. And, you know, he's getting his fair crack at it, you know, next year. And I think, you know, the intention there isn't to put it on his shoulders. It's genuinely to give the team options further down the line. And for me, you know, F1, it's fine margins. There's a load of people who are depending on a driver to deliver each weekend, and we need to make sure we've got the best drivers in the race car, not just now but also in the future.
Well, if there's anyone who knows what pressure is all about and how it works in racing, it's his father, Mick Doohan.
Yes,
a motorcycle champion. He's a very, very tough nut, and I'm sure he gives Jack a lot of very good advice. You've been generous with your time. I must let you get back to your day job, but I just want to talk to you about this season, because, you know, I've been in this sport a long time now, and there've been some competitive seasons, and there've been some hopelessly uncompetitive seasons. And I think on the competitive swing scale, if you like, I see this one being pretty much close to 10. I mean, all the indicators are that you're at the end of a rules set. A lot of resources going into the 2026 cars, obviously, because it could be a real opportunity for teams like Alpine to make a jump up, like we saw with Mercedes back at the beginning of the turbo era. And you could see already in the second half of last year that the cars are just getting closer and closer together, particularly in the part of the field that you race in.
So, yeah, there's no breathing room. Yeah,
there is no breathing room.
I think it's,
what's going to make what's going to make the difference in 2026 to having a good season?
I think it's really hard to judge, because you know where you finished in Abu Dhabi. You know kind of what you were targeting as your launch car and where you want to be. You're then sort of keeping one eye of, okay, well, can we do all of that we wanted to do? Because that's going to hurt 26 a bit. But I think as well, you know, the whole grid there is so tight. I mean, we saw those last few races, particularly in the midfield. I think, you know, those top three, four teams have still got a little bit of legs and margin on the midfield. Hopefully we can close that up a little bit. But I just think it's going to be an exciting season because of that. You're going to have battles up and down the grid. And I think for us as a team, we also need to keep our feet on the ground. You know, we did really well to recover back to sixth. It's going to be bloody hard to stay fifth, sixth, seventh, because it is tight. You know, Brazil and Qatar were massive weekends for the team, but they don't come around often. So we've just got to try and deliver from the beginning. And I think, you know, my one goal really for us as Alpine is to have kind of a bit of a boring flat season where, you know, we're doing a good job in the midfield there, but, you know, the highs are not too high and the lows are not too low.
Yeah.
Because that's what will allow us to keep good momentum and also keep building what we're doing here, because 2026 is a big opportunity. But by the same token, you know, you want to keep cementing what we did the end of last season in 25 as well. But as a fan out there, you know, I think it's going to be very exciting to see not only the rookies on the grid, seeing Lewis in red. You know, I don't think it's sad to say, but, you know, you can't help but be emotional when he won at Silverstone as an Englishman, my home track, in a way, my High Tech being based there, what he did. You know, I had a bit of I'm not ashamed to say it, a sort of a tear in my eye, because it was a massive win there.
It was amazing.
And then seeing him this year roll out in red, you know, I think that's great for F1. I think obviously it's going to be an amazing season to see all of those battles as well. Yeah.
Well, listen, it's fantastic. Thank you again very much for your time. Thanks for inviting me here to Enstone. It's great to come back, and look forward to seeing you on the road this season.
Thank you.
All
Okay, so let's start with the juicy bit first from that interview then, Oleg, the drivers. You wrote a piece on Autosport over the weekend about the pressure that them signing Colapinto as a reserve driver is going to put on Doohan. So what's Alpine thinking here?
Yeah, I don't know. First of all, I think I would rather talk about what Franco Colapinto himself thinking about signing with Alpine. And that would be, you know, he had everything ready for him in terms of being a reserve driver at Williams, right? And they prepared the TPC program with for him to test the two-year-old car. And he could, you know, still do all the things they promised to him in this new role at Alpine. They promised him now. But I don't think he had any reason to change from Williams to Alpine if he wouldn't want a little bit more. And I think having done these nine races, I think his goal is to come back to the grid. And for me, at least, it's a clear sign that, you know, in Franco's position, he wants to come back to the grid, and he probably understands that Williams is not able to provide him with that chance. And it seems that there is a bigger chance at Alpine, and there is only realistically one seat which he's aiming for, and that's the one of Jack Doohan's, right? Because, you know, Jack, he probably deserves to be in F1, but did he really force himself into the championship? Did he really force himself onto the grid? Because at the end of the day, you can also say that Jag was probably promoted partly because Alpine simply ran out of other good options. Maybe you could argue they could sign Valtteri Bottas or whoever else. But in any case, they needed to wait for another driver. And Jack was part of their academy. He's grown within the team. And it's fair to give them a chance. But, you know, his junior career doesn't look, the stats of it doesn't look spectacular. So he probably does deserve a seat in F1. But, yeah, there is every chance that he would not perform as maybe other rookies did recently. And I think it's only fair for Alpine as well to, you know, have someone like Franco, race-ready driver who would jump in the car. And he proved that. He proved that when he jumped in the car in Monza and he scored the points in Baku. And to have him on the bench in the reserve role capacity is a huge boost for Alpine. It's a, well, you call it backup option, I don't know. But, you know, it definitely puts some pressure on Jack. I don't know what you make of it, but, well.
You can say that again. I mean, Mark, there's a saying in Formula One that's been around as long as I have and you have, which is in Formula One, you're either giving pressure or you're taking it. And this to me looks to me like a classic example of this. And you've been close up, you know, in your previous life as a mechanic at McLaren, and you've seen like how that works, the dynamic. How do you feel when you look at the situation of Doohan and the presence of Colapinto?
It's kind of indicative of the sort of, if I'm really honest, the way that the Alpine organization has operated over the last few years. If you look at the sort of management changes, there's always been a kind of instability, I think, from, you know, if you came in as team principal, and I've got to be honest, I feel a little bit like this with Ollie Oakes. There's always going to be a little bit of uncertainty about how long you're there for. It's like a football manager almost, isn't it, in this team. You've been put in that position, but it feels like as soon as things don't go very well, and given that Jack Doohan's a rookie, he's just starting his career, there's inevitably going to be times when things are not going to go that well, particularly in the first few races and months. It feels like because they've already got a backup option in Colapinto on the driver front ready to go, that maybe he's not going to get given the sort of length of time that maybe a rookie in this sport should be given. And I know that Formula One's a results-based industry. You know, you've got to be looking to try and maximise everything. But 2026 really was the perfect opportunity to bring rookies into this sport. It's why we're seeing so many of them come into the grid for this year, because really 25 is the perfect opportunity. 26 is when the real opportunity for most teams comes with the massive rules reset. And therefore, if you're a Williams or if you're an Alpine, you could just turn out doing a really strong job and catapult your way up the grid. And you want your drivers to be fully up to speed at that point. So with a rookie like Jack Doohan, you would have expected before the Colapinto news to be given that time, 2025 being a learning year, find your feet, get up to speed, have a full assault on the championship, perhaps, particularly with Alpine bringing in, Mercedes engines. There's a real opportunity at that team. And I just wonder, having had a Colapinto now come into the background, whether that puts maybe too much pressure on a young Jack Doohan. We'll have to see. But it feels like it's already kind of in the background. If we're really honest, it feels like Jack Doohan has got a very difficult challenge ahead, which he had anyway. Now maybe it's even harder.
How much of a help do you think it was for him, Mark, that he got that one Grand Prix, the complete weekend in Abu Dhabi at the end of last season? You know, they parachuted him in for that because they felt that, you know, he could then obviously analyse the data, see what he did well, see what he did wrong, and have the winter sort of knowing what a Grand Prix weekend feels like. That must be a big boost to his chances of hitting the ground running, because Melbourne, you know, home Grand Prix for an Aussie. You know, obviously you've got Piastri there who'll take most of the attention of the media and stuff, but still Doohan is a very famous surname in Australia. And I know how that media situation works. I've seen it up close many times. I worked for Australian TV for many years, so I know exactly how that works. How much do you think it'll help him that he did that preparation weekend?
I think, as Ollie said in the interview there, you know, he did it. The team did it mostly for the reason of getting him up to speed. So he knows what to expect. Coming in, particularly given that he's an Australian, going to the Australian Grand Prix, which would have been his debut, would have been his first Grand Prix, the sort of assault on your senses could have been overwhelming, as if becoming a Formula One driver for the first time isn't enough. Everything else, as you just described alongside that, could really be something that takes away from your ability to focus on performance. So having the understanding of what a Grand Prix weekend looks like, what the demands on you are, how you've got to work with your engineering team, your mechanics, all of that, just the procedures, having that as a known quantity really helps. But also from the team's point of view, it's exactly the same. Knowing how Jack works as a driver, the engineering team need to know how to get the best out of him, how he operates, what his feedback's like. And now they've got a real insight into all of that. And it should just make the whole transition a little bit smoother. And that's all you can ever try and do. A new Formula One driver coming in is going to face massive pressure on any day, whatever it is and wherever it is you make your debut. So anything you can do as a team to try and smooth that a little bit, take away the sort of spikes and troughs on a graph of what your weekend looks like as a driver and sort of level it out, even to a tiny degree, has got to help enable that driver to bring the focus back to where it needs to be, which is putting performance into the car and on the racetrack.
Yeah, it takes away quite a big element of the unknown, doesn't it? I think that's that element. It's a bit more of a known quantity. Oleg, I continue to be astonished by the level of preparation that young drivers get now. I think it's been one of the big stories, really, of the last few years. And Fernando Alonso, I remember speaking to him last year, and he told me that for sure these young drivers are more prepared and even, in some senses, more talented in that way when they come in. But perhaps they miss a bit on the personality side because they're kind of, they have people that speak for them. They have people that do things for them, you know, the way that they're kind of cosseted in these academies and these programs. But there's no getting away from the fact that the amount of hours they can spend in simulators and running in two-year-old F1 cars, which you referenced earlier on, the result is that here we are, 2025, we have Doohan, Hadjar, Antonelli, Behrmann, Bortoleto, and Lawson's only done 11 Grand Prix. I mean, he's still, relatively speaking, a rookie. So that's 6 out of 20 drivers, 30% of the field are basically rookies. Do you think this is good for the sport?
Well, I think as long as we still have 20 best drivers in the world, as we all like to say it in Formula One, it's all fine. And I think guys like Oliver Behrmann and Franco Colapinto were able to prove last year is that these guys, they can really jump into the car and then deliver straight away because they are good enough. And now it is really, you know, During the last couple of years, we always talked about how valuable experience is in Formula One. And I think that becomes a little bit less of a factor. And, you know, these guys are now proving that if you're simply fast driver, fast and capable driver, you're able to deliver straight away. The only bit that experience probably helps you to do better is, you know, to react to, you know, different circumstances, changeable conditions, whether it's, you know, low grip, track temperature, whether it's weather changing or, you know, red flags during the sessions. And the experience simply, you know, helps you to react to it quicker because you've been through it before. You've experienced all that. But if we talk about the normal conditions, you know, more or less predictable sessions, and we've seen it many times that rookie drivers can come in and, you know, be as fast as regular drivers, and the speed is not the issue anymore for them, because simply because all of the factors you mentioned as well, you know, these guys are driving their simulators 8 hours a day. And that's one of the things Gabriel Bortoletto mentioned in one of his first interviews, that he simply has his sim set up next to his bed. So he wakes up, he goes to have breakfast, or maybe doesn't even skip it, and then goes straight into a sim session or racing. So because they've been, and that's partly what explains what you said, like the lack of, you know, personality. It's because all their lives are about racing since they were kids, 6, 7, 8 years old. And, you know, they've experienced only racing in their lives. And it's a bit, all of them are now a bit like Max Verstappen, you know. They live and breathe racing, whether it's online, in karting, or whatever. And it's fascinating. It's a new generation. It's a different generation. And yeah, I think we just have to get used to the fact that they are really good. And maybe even, as Fernando mentioned, yeah, to you, they are maybe even better. But that's better than the previous generation. But that's just a natural development.
Yeah, it's interesting though, because once you get into Formula One, it's a head game. It's you can be as prepared as you like. I mean, and Ollie referenced that in the interview there. You know, Behrmann had an awful lot of preparation. So when he got a very short notice call to jump into the Ferrari in Jeddah, you know, he knew which way the steering wheel worked and all those things. That's not the same as going out and doing a great job. That is all about soaking up the pressure and being able to deliver. And that's all going on inside the head, which is quite spectacular. And it's for me, it's a really, really interesting development. And I think once they get into Formula One, obviously they develop their personalities. They start getting, you know, the wives and girlfriends. They start getting, you know, invitations on the red carpets here and there. They get their own social media followers going into the millions and millions, and they realize that they are a personal brand, and then they've got to do something with that. So it's going to be interesting in the case of all of these youngsters to see who succeeds. Just shifting back to Oliver for a second then, Mark. I mean, I mentioned to him that he's a bit of a throwback in a way in terms of his pathway to becoming an F1 team principal. He's had his own very successful team in F4, in F3, F2, brought a lot of great drivers through. George Russell raced for him quite early on in his career, and then took that step up to being an F1 team principal. So like Eddie Jordan, Christian Horner, there's many, many other examples in the past. But more recently, we've seen this kind of new trend of engineers becoming F1 team principals, like Laurent Mekies at VCarb or James Vowles at Williams, Andrea Stella at McLaren has just won the Constructors' Championship in that role. How do you see the differing qualities that these two groups have?
I think it's a little bit too easy to just put them into two groups. I think the reality is that it doesn't really matter where you come from in terms of which side of the sport you've risen up through. I think when it comes to leading a team of 1,000 to 2,000 people, that's the skill set you need to be able to be proficient at. You need to be able to manage people and to work with people. And I think if you think about those people you've mentioned, you know, Andrea Stella is someone that I'm very familiar with through McLaren. the reason that he has been such a successful team principal isn't necessarily because he's come from an engineering background. It's because he's got this unbelievable affinity with the people that work there. He's been able to connect with those people. I keep hearing Oliver Oakes talk about this empowering the team. That's exactly what most of these guys do. And it's exactly what you need to be able to do to bring a team in the right direction. Don't forget, all of these teams, if you think about McLaren, they have an amazing engineering team. They don't necessarily need Andreas in that role anymore. And so he's moved into a role where he just has to enable the engineering team to do their jobs and to empower them, to give them the freedom, and not really to sort of micromanage as an engineer anymore. I think that actually that could be a negative if you can't sit to one side your engineering background and actually just sit there and look after this team of people. So I think a Formula One team is this huge group of people, all from lots of different disciplines, but generally they're all the very best at what they do. They're elite level people in pretty much every area. The team principal or whoever it is leading that group just has to be almost like a conductor of an orchestra, has to be able to bring those people in at the right time, to give them the freedom when they need it at the right time, the resources at the right moment. It's really all about leading people. So I think that's the biggest, most valuable skill set for an F1 team principal, much more so than whether you've come through the operations side or the engineering side.
Well, look, I mean, he's got Flavio Briatore alongside him, and he spelled out there that, you know, they basically, there isn't like Flavio takes care of this and Oliver takes care of that. Although in practice, the reality is Oliver sort of takes care of the racing bit. But Flavio's got an awful lot of experience. Obviously, he's very good on the financial side, the money side, the commercial side. What's your read on the way those two operate? I mean, from looking at them in the paddock and being in their motorhome and what have you, the body language looks really good. Oliver doesn't look like he's scared of Flavio. But what's your, you've had plenty of experience of him. What do you think, Oleg, of how that relationship works?
Well, I think what's fascinating about Oli, he doesn't look to be scared of anyone. And, you know, he's very natural, you know, he jokes all the time, and he knows his way with people, whoever they are. And he's been dealing throughout his career with a lot of different characters. And Flavio is just the next one, probably. And to me, it looks like they are operating as one. They are constantly in the dialogue, and as you mentioned, probably Flavio is taking care of about more of strategic decisions, and then Oliver is taking care of racing. But it does seem that they try to, you know, at least update each other, bounce ideas of each other, and they simply run it all together. And you know, they're also in dialogue with Luca Di Meo all the time, and you know, one of the things he mentioned as well is that they, as Oli arrived, they had a little WhatsApp group for three of them, Flavio, Luca and himself. And you know, I think they are really, the key for that operation would be how they can all understand each other and have the same values, and you know, try to be united in that, because I think that was one of the issues Alpine faced during the previous years with the previous management structures, is that, you know, it did seem that some people at the top wanted different things from the team. And I think one of the things that Oli and Flavio have to do is to make sure that you know, the direction is clear and they pull together.
The one thing I would say is that I think at the moment things are going quite well in that organization. If you think about from when Oli came in mid-season, or from the August break, as you said at the start, it's been this upward trajectory. So it's very easy to be, you know, for everyone to look like they're on the same page and look like they're all best buddies and things are going well, when it is. What I worry about is when things don't go so well, then what happens? Oli Oakes is this young team principal. You know, there's always going to be this question at Alpine / Renault, who's really in charge? And he talked in the interview about them both sort of working together, no one really taking control of one thing or the other. They do everything together. I think when things don't go so well, that's when we may well really find out who actually is in charge. And that could be a little bit more spiky.
Finally, let's turn our attention to this season ahead, which is now coming rapidly on the horizon. I think it's going to be the most competitive in living memory, given that it's the last one to this set of rules. The resources, which are now cost cap, we haven't had that before to this extent, where basically you do have a limit on how much you can spend. That's being steered towards predominantly the 2026 cars. And we saw how close it got last season, particularly in the final half of the season. So what do we think about this season coming up, and where can we expect Alpine to be in all of this? Do you think they can get sixth again, Oleg?
I think, James, if you give me $100, I would bet exactly on that, P6 in the championship, because probably that's where they do belong after, you know, so many management changes in the recent years. I don't really think they are ready yet to fight for something bigger, but at the same time, they are works team, and they have to be in front of the likes of Haas, the likes of Racing Bulls or Williams, or even Sauber at the state they are in now. Looking at the bigger picture, I think, yeah, we'll all expect a tight battle at the front, and it's going to be interesting to see really how the teams, you know, split their resources between 25 and 26. And I'm not necessarily sure that all the teams will have the same strategy, and Ferrari is going to be interesting to look at, for example, because, you know, the team hasn't won the championship since a lot of years. And if they sniff a chance of fighting for something big, I don't think they're going to stop, especially now, having Lewis as well driving one of their cars. So I think that's going to be really fascinating to see. And also to see Lando and Max going at it again, fighting for the title from the first round. I think that's what we're all hoping for.
I agree entirely. I think it's going to be a fascinating season on so many levels. You know, all three of us, we operate in the media side of things. We tell stories for a living. There are so many storylines running through this season. And I think Oleg's right. I think the really interesting side of this is, how much are people going to be able to dedicate resources to this year versus next, and how that dynamic changes as the season unfolds? Because what you're likely to end up with is probably one or two teams that end up fighting at the front. And when there's a championship, you know, at stake here, that's a huge deal. A championship is an unbelievably difficult thing to achieve. And yes, 2026, big opportunity for everybody. But if you're Ferrari, if you're McLaren, if you're Red Bull, and there's a chance of a championship at 25, you are not going to want to let that go, because you don't know what's going to happen in 26. And at that point, it's going to be who kind of twitches first in terms of pulling the resources out of this year versus keeping that development running throughout the season as it goes on. So I think that's fascinating. So many youngsters and rookies coming into the sport. That's going to be fascinating to watch as well. Some Kimi Antonelli at Mercedes, I think everyone's really intrigued. Of course, Lewis Hamilton at Ferrari is a great story. A new teammate for Max Verstappen. How on earth will Liam Lawson get on? And so many other storylines up and down this field, all with the background knowledge that we're building up to a season in 26, which is a total reset of the sport, and literally could see a team like Williams, who've been right down the back of the field, ending up right at the front. Who knows? I think there's so much excitement. This could be peak F1.
Don't build it up too much, Mark. Good Lord. Well, listen, if you enjoyed this discussion with Oliver Oakes and want more, look out for the first edition of the sumptuous new look monthly Autosport, which comes out this week on the 23rd of January, which features a 6-page interview that Oleg has done with the Alpine team principal. And remember, you can get in touch with us at James Allen on F1 on X, or email us at jamesallenonf1@autosport.com with any questions or comments that you've got. And we have this intriguing one from Motorsport Fan, nice and generic, on X, reacting to the news that some of the rookie drivers have taken numbers with historic associations. So Bortoleto has gone for Mansell and Vettel's number 5. Hadjar has Nico Rosberg's number 6. Doohan has gone for Raikkonen's number 7. Kimi Antonelli went for number 12, which is associated with both Ayrton Senna and Niki Lauda in the past. And Motorsport Fan says, I'm not sure I would have taken 5, 6 or 7. There would always be some comparison in the media. That's how they operate. And that could put some pressure on the youngsters. What do you think about that, guys?
I think personally for me, I think a number in Formula One, I don't think a number like a football shirt, I don't really think it matters to the person wearing it. I think it matters more to the fans and to the media who want to create stories out of it. The guy behind the wheel will not care.
Yeah, I'm with Mark on that one. I don't think that they will, when they will be sitting in their cars, they won't think about it.
Well, I think Lewis is pretty attached to number 44, given that he's got a company with that name and an old project and all the rest of it. And the one number that everyone cares about, of course, is number 1. That's the one that they really want to have on their car. And Max Verstappen, well, he's the guy carrying it going into 2025. We're going to round it up there then. My thanks to Oleg Karpov and to Mark Priestley. You can read Oleg's writing on Autosport. And do check out Mark's podcast, Pit Lane Life Lessons. You might learn something. Thanks to Dre, Matt and Jason on production. And thanks to you for listening. Please click to follow or subscribe. Leave us a review and a rating and tell all your F1 mad friends about us. We'll be back with another podcast very soon.
It is Ryan Seacrest here. There was a recent social media trend which consisted of flying on a plane with no music, no movies, no entertainment. But a better trend would be going to ChumbaCasino.com. It's like having a mini social casino in your pocket. Chumba Casino has over 100 online casino-style games, all absolutely free. It's the most fun you can have online and on a plane. So grab your free welcome bonus now at ChumbaCasino.com. Sponsored by Chumba Casino.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 21 plus. Terms and conditions apply.